for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The UN has called for $460 million to aid Pakistanis devastated by record floods. The Taliban executes a pregnant woman in Afghanistan. Moscow plays down reports that widespread fires pose a threat to a nuclear research center. And accountability is unclear in Israel's investigation of a deadly Gaza flotilla raid. Joining me for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Daniel Dombey of the Financial Times, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Yoki Driesen of National Journal Magazine. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yoki Driesen, the U.S. military seems to be pushing for a slower drawdown in Afghanistan. Is that part of, is part of the problem there, the training of Afghan soldiers?
It is. I mean, training of Afghan soldiers, training of Afghan police. Of course, a broad problem is that since the surge strategy began, and before that, since the counterinsurgency strategy began, progress has been at best mixed. And if you were going to look at it probably with a more cold eye, you'd say that things are going worse, not better. It's very hard to point to really any measurable progress. General McChrystal, before he was pushed out over the Rolling Stone interview, he had raised a lot of eyebrows in Washington because of periodic assessments that proved way, way too over-optimistic. In Marja, he famously said they would come in with government in a box, something that one of his advisors told me later they were all shrugging, kind of rolling their eyes, because they had intentionally told him not to use that phrase, and he used it anyway. Marja has no government. Reconstruction there is very slow. He had talked about Kandahar starting in the spring or summer as a sort of test of it would prove what had been done in Marja successfully. Marja wasn't successful. Kandahar has not really begun. So part of it is that the training is slow. Part of it is the progress is slow. Part of it is that the command has to dig out of a public relations hole of its own making, having made over-optimistic comments for the better part of a year.
Susan.
Well, in fact, if you look just what's played out over the last few days in an obscure corner of Afghanistan near Kunar province, you can see kind of a dramatic example of why things aren't working out as planned. Although you continue to hear these very optimistic numbers, the Afghan National Army has trained its quota of people. In fact, they launched an operation in this obscure corner where the Taliban have held sway. And what it turns out is that it's turned into a disastrous military operation. They've had to call in, I believe, the Americans and other NATO allies for support. And, you know, there are many dead. It's not clear, but I think it's an indication that this is not an Afghan National Army that's going to be ready to stand up and take on functions that the U.S. would like to hand over to them.
And yet, I understand General Petraeus is going to be on Meet the Press with David Gregory this weekend in Afghanistan, and he remain somewhat optimistic.
Well, I think you have to remember, of course, that General Petraeus is many things. He's very accomplished in many, many ways, one of which is he's extremely good at dealing with the press. Now, this is something that you could never say with General McChrystal. So he's a professional optimist as well as someone with a record that's beyond compare. And he says, I think, in this interview, some parts of which have already been released, that he sticks by the July 2011 date. The trouble is that President Obama, when he announced this July 2011 date, tried to have it both ways. He announced that a surge was urgent, and he announced that a withdrawal was important. And as that could have worked out if we'd had a steady record of success this year. It hasn't, and therefore he has to decide what's more important, the surge or the withdrawal. Is the withdrawal going to be token? Is it going to be significant? You have two big different groups. You have the Democrats and much of a nation that is sceptical about this war, a coalition in favour of a war that's fraying all the time. On the other hand, you have Republicans and much of a military that feels that you need to commit resources for a longer period of time. General Petraeus is far too canny to declare his hand openly on network TV. But nevertheless, there are some very fundamental questions coming up which will be asked in the remaining months of this year.
Susan.
Well, in fact, a key date to watch for looking ahead on the calendar is December, when they have promised a review of the Afghan strategy. Obviously, some of that work is going to be taking place this fall. It's going to come in the context after the midterm elections in the United States. That's going to be a very crucial decision point for President Obama as he comes out of the midterm elections. If his party has lost seats, if he's looking forward to launching his own re-election campaign, what is the Afghan context in which that campaign is going to take place? I think that's a really crucial decision that's being moved toward. And General Petraeus, obviously, is now going to play a key role in shaping that decision. So they're trying to leave it so that they have as many options open as possible, I think, right now.
Yeah, and I think as we talk about this, we come back to fundamental questions. We've been through two reviews so far, but really we've remained on a trajectory that, to be honest, George W. Bush started when he began the surge, even just before leaving office. There are fundamental questions that need to be answered that people in the administration acknowledge. For example, is an idea of a unitary Afghan state that wins the loyalty of Pashtuns even a coherent one? Is it possible to win an insurgency when there are safe havens in Pakistan and lines of transit to those? And how important is this really to getting at al-Qaeda and the people who attack the US when you judge that there are only 50 or so al-Qaeda people in Afghanistan and that their safe havens are in Pakistan and that they're increasingly active in places like Somalia and Yemen? Those are big questions. They've been asked before. They've not necessarily been satisfactorily answered. They won't go away.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, part of this, to me, is there's a bit of a time warp quality. I mean, this question that Dan raised about is it a unitary Afghan state, is that plausible? That was the exact question being asked about Iraq 3 years ago. So you have the in some cases the same question. In some cases, you have the same factors here. The economy, not great then, obviously much worse now. A party and a country that had turned against the war, that was the case with Iraq. Afghanistan was the good war. Afghanistan is now a war that people have turned against as much as they were with Iraq. And what's interesting to me is now the administration is doing what the Bush administration did very successfully, which was make General Petraeus the face of the war, make General Petraeus the person who will testify on the Hill, the person who does the interviews, the person who can try to sell what is an increasingly unpopular war, and one where the goals of the war are at best vague and at worst, you know, unattainable and just so ephemeral that they're hard to even know what they are.
And in the meantime, you have this UN report on rising civilian casualties, Susan.
Well, that's right. These numbers that came out are very striking, and they show the continued, you could argue, Iraqization on some level of Afghanistan. Many of those casualties that are documented in the UN report are a reflection of the increasing use of suicide bombers and other IED tactics in Afghanistan. And again, they reflect the fact that this is almost 9 years into the war. I mean, talk about a deja vu quality to this. I was very struck in there was a New York Times piece this week that talked about, they gave the impression that the U.S. military was sort of behind pushing for a longer stay than July 2011 in Afghanistan. And, you know, there's an incredible background quote in that story that basically says, well, we need to stay the course because really it's only in the last year that we've begun to do things right in Afghanistan. So, you know, it's, where's the accountability for that, right? You know, there has been a change in civilian administrations, obviously, from Bush to Obama. But what's striking is where is the military leadership? So they had, by their own acknowledgement, for 8 years getting it wrong in Afghanistan. And I think that's part of why you've seen this really dramatic draining of public support for the war.
And what about this money probe as far as President Karzai is concerned? How does that complicate matters, Daniel?
Well, it complicates matters enormously because the administration has been pushing Karzai to crack down on corruption. particularly vigorously ever since he began his second term of office, and it made sure that he inserted some language. Washington basically dictated part of President Karzai's second inaugural address at the end of last year when he said he would crack down on corruption. It said that it was very keen to hear what he said at a recent conference in Kabul about the brass tacks of corruption. One person described me as what he came up with as a giant nothing burger in Kabul. And then you have this specific case of a former national security advisor who apparently was, according to two independent bodies which are very important supposedly in cracking down on corruption, supposedly on the take, supposedly interested in securing for his son a $10,000 car. What happened? What did Mr. Karzai do? He's now asserted personal control in many ways over those two anti-corruption units. Exactly the opposite kind of signal that one's trying to send. Mm. But the bigger question is, can you really crack down on corruption in a country like Afghanistan while flooding it with money?
Yeah, we often on this show talk about very serious things, and they're said in serious ways as they deserve. This one is a serious one, but it's also one that to me has the sweep of a really bad Hollywood movie. I mean, the specific allegation here is that a hawala, an Afghan, and it something that's common in the Islamic world, a way of transferring cash, transferred out of Afghanistan. Listen to the numbers, because I wrote them down because they're so shocking. Between the start of 2007 and February of 2010, over $3 billion in cash. Just think about it visually, $3 billion
in cash. I just threw my pen down on the table.
And one particular bank, I use bank loosely, but the one that's under investigation because it's tied directly to the Karzai family over that period, $2.8 billion. So when you think about the corruption issue, which is such an important one and such one that is so endemic to the culture, it's hard to get your arms quite around. But then you have the specific visual of people taking bags of cash, enough of those bags that billions of dollars in cash traveled out of an airport over the course of less than 3 years.
And
it's just shocking.
At the same time, you've got people in this country, taxpayers, paying for part of, if not all, of that money going out of the country without jobs, without homes. Really disgraceful. Yoki Driessen of National Journal Magazine, Susan Glasser of She's Executive Editor of Foreign Policy, Daniel Dombey, U.S. Diplomatic Correspondent for Financial Times. Welcome back. Here's our first email from Nisha in Washington, D.C. Would you discuss Jeff Goldberg's article in The Atlantic about the potential for Israel bombing Iran in the next year? Daniel.
Well, this is a very striking article in The Atlantic, and I think it's actually a point of reference, so probably people should go and read it. Its most striking assertion is that the writer says that there's more than 50% chance that Israel will strike Iran over the next year or so. And he paints a very depressing picture. Right at the start of the interview, the article, he says, well, things could go right, sanctions could work, Iran could rein in its nuclear program, but none of this is likely. And this is something that's seen as an existential threat, and in particular by the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's father, who exercises enormous influence over Mr. Netanyahu, is a very eminent scholar of, among things, the Spanish Inquisition and attempts to exterminate the Jewish people in the past. But I would simply just say one thing before we get very excited about this article. People sometimes jump to conclusions about what the Iranian program is perhaps trying to do and what the US is trying to avoid. When you talk to people in the CIA and elsewhere, they say, we don't know if Iran is going to try and get a bomb. We know that Iran is trying to be in a position where it can develop a bomb at short notice. And what we want to do is avoid that. Now, if we aren't talking about a prospect of an Iranian nuclear test in the next few years, but simply of Iran being in a better position to develop a nuclear bomb, the administration may fail. It may not get what it wants, but there may not be a traumatic event that forces anyone's hand. And I would add one other thing that Mr. Goldberg hints at in his piece, which is there's a very strong likelihood that an Israeli strike would fail. They probably could only fly over countries like Saudi Arabia once. And if you're trying to boost Israeli power, if you're trying to face off Iran, there's really nothing more disastrous you could do than fail in the attempt.
Well, I think it is a very powerful and deeply reported article, which makes it interesting, in particular discussion of Prime Minister Netanyahu's 100-year-old father and his very hardline views when it comes to this subject, I think are worth reading alone. But, you know, it strikes me a couple things. One, it's certainly making, by default, a very aggressive case for why something needs to be done. And it gives the appearance, in effect, of trying to box in President Obama and the people here in Washington. Goldberg had very extensive cooperation, clearly, from Israeli officials, military officials. He mentions in the article visiting a dozen offices inside the Israeli military establishment. They all have the same picture of three Israeli military jets flying over what was once a concentration camp in Poland. It's meant to symbolize the reasons for Israeli military force. But I came away from reading this article very strongly convinced that the reason for this extensive cooperation was, in fact, to put pressure on the American administration. There's very specific time frames. If Obama doesn't make it clear that he's going to do something in the next year, that's when we'll have to act. And so I think it should be read as that sort of a document as well. And it clearly has inspired a whole new debate in the blogosphere amongst commentators about the need and possibility of an Israeli strike on Iran. Also, potentially, the question of whether Iran itself, if feeling so much under threat, might be cause to strike out.
Yoki.
Yeah, there was a moment ago about the sort of black box that is Iran, that people from the outside, CIA, you know, Mossad, other intelligence agencies, look in, try to decipher what's going on, but don't really know. What I was struck by reading the piece was another aspect of that similar kind of black box dynamic that a lot of the Israeli officials that Jeff interviewed mentioned pretty openly, which was that they don't understand President Obama, that they say that they look at him and they don't really know what his actions mean towards them, what his actions mean towards Iran, what his core beliefs are. And if you look at something where it's already dangerous and already one big element of uncertainty about what Iran is doing could itself be a spur to action, when you have this other big element of uncertainty of not knowing how serious the U.S. takes the threat. I mean, obviously, U.S. officials talk about it and take it seriously, but seriously enough to bless an Israeli strike, seriously enough to condone an American strike, those questions are very far from clear. And it was interesting that with, obviously, President Bush, his views towards Israel, his actions towards Israel were very clear. President Clinton, his views, his actions were very clear. With the Israelis, they feel like something fundamental is different, rightly or wrongly. They feel like something is fundamentally different about this administration.
Susan.
I think that's true, although even the article takes pains to point out that although the surround sound might have been dramatically different between President Bush and President Obama, in fact, it was Bush himself who was openly derisive of the American conservatives who were constantly making the case for. He called them, quote unquote, the bomber boys. He was talking about conservative columnists Charles Krauthammer and Bill Kristol, I believe. And he himself made it very clear that already embroiled in two wars in the Middle East, he wasn't going to consider a strike in Iran. Remember that this is not the first wave of publicity and anxiety that we've had over the possibility of an Israeli military strike. Do you remember all the articles in the last several years of the Bush administration about how a strike was imminent, the U.S. was doing the planning, the Israelis were doing the planning? You know, it didn't happen. And now, retrospectively, the Israelis and the Americans acknowledge that, you know, Bush considered it a non-starter.
I'm reluctant to almost to ask this, but is it a case of advocacy journalism?
I wouldn't really want to. I mean, I wouldn't. It's a serious piece of journalism. He talks to many people. But I think the people he spoke to had a clear agenda for why they wanted to talk to him. I mean, this is not a piece of propaganda. I think there are no facts in it that are distorted. He is conscientious in describing Bush's own aversion to this. And in fact, Bush not only didn't want to strike on his own account, but actually took measures to stop the Israelis from carrying out a
strike.
Susan,
how do you see it?
But I just simply wanted to add is that it doesn't draw out some of the conclusions that aren't helpful to it. So, for example, one thing in it that it says, which is very important, is it says that General Ashkenazi, the chief of staff of the Israeli army, is against a strike.
That's
right. Now, I think, therefore, the conclusion that an Israeli strike is 50% or more than 50% likely over the next year or so has to be taken with a big grain of salt because of the very own reporting in the piece itself.
Whether you call it advocacy journalism or not, this is a very talented journalist who also has a very strong point of view. And you can read it on his blog every day on the Atlantic's website. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's important that people take the context there. And I found the piece to be in the end, alarmist in the takeaways that a reader is meant to come away with from it. And there's not that much basis for really evaluating. We'll have to wait and see over the next year how this plays out. But it's an alarming piece in its detailed scenarios.
Alarming and alarmist, Yogi?
I don't think it's alarmist because the concerns that Israeli officials have, again, whether we as Americans share them, those concerns are real. But I share Susan's point. I mean, I read it not thinking this is a chest-pounding, great, let's go bomb Iran or hope the Israelis do it for us piece, but rather a, oh my God, look how many terrible things might happen over the next year.
Okay, and speaking of terrible things, look at that flooding in Pakistan. The UN is asking for $460 million to help Pakistan regarding the floods, and yet, isn't there a certain reluctance on the part of Pakistan to accept international aid, Yoki?
And that's one reason why you've seen such really, even for someone who is unpopular to begin with, such incredibly visceral criticism of the president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari. He was traveling Europe during much of the initial part of the flooding, didn't really cut the trip short, initially didn't declare how serious it was. He was very reluctant to sort of say publicly what was being said by people on the ground, that this was the worst disaster in the history of Pakistan. And there's a feeling that had he been quicker to respond and quicker to declare how bad it was, you would have had more aid coming in sooner. I mean, you've had already about $150 million that's been pledged or paid, the U.S. being the biggest single donor. You've had U.S. military helicopters and U.S. military assets kind of flooding into Pakistan, which has, I think, been, you don't want to say helpful because it's such a depressing and sad tragedy, but to the point of view of the image of the U.S., having U.S. helicopters flying in aid can only help as far as the image goes. But he comes in for criticism. It reminds me a little bit of the Bush criticism that he took after Katrina, where he was away and flew over briefly but didn't really respond for a few days. Here you had a president on a trip to Europe. Is not that big of a deal. When your country has the biggest disaster in its history, he should have been back sooner.
Yes, in fact, it was his niece wrote a very scathing piece on our website. She called it Zardari's Katrina in the piece. And it was only yesterday. We are, days and days and days into this catastrophe. It was only yesterday that he made his first visit to the flood zone, which basically at this point is a massive percentage of the entire country of Pakistan.
So could you have Taliban insurgents sort of take advantage of this situation?
Well, I think there are fears that that's already happening in the sense that it's always one of the great advantages of Islamist movements in the world is that they often have very active social programs. And you already have groups which are linked to people like Lashkar-e-Taiba, the people behind the Mumbai bombing that have gone out and helped people on the ground building support. You have against that a lumbering government and really fundamentally a problem about the legitimacy of a civilian government. If you have a civilian government whose popularity is 20% to begin with, that's seen basically as a feudal bauble, possession of feudal lords, the last thing you want to do is manage something like this. I would just add one final point on this, which is the figures of this are terrifying. This is a zone that goes on for about 1,000 kilometres. 14 million people are affected. But natural disasters are very rarely purely natural. They usually are the result of bad planning, corruption, awful construction, the problems of that have been put in place by successive governments, and this is no exception to this. So the mere fact of this disaster is a challenge to the way that Pakistan's been governed for years.
Susan.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think it really becomes immediately puts the story of Pakistan's lack of meaningful governance right back on the front burner. And then just on this question of U.S. aid, I mean, what's extraordinary here, right, and very depressing is that the United States has literally spent billions and billions of dollars in Pakistan over the last decade very, very ineffectively. And so the idea that you're going to make an appeal, as Richard Holbrooke did just yesterday, I believe, you know, he's the special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's looking at it from the point of view of, is this going to cause a further weakening of our position in this already sort of catastrophic region? Making appeals to Americans at this point, to be generous, unfortunately, I think that, you know, that well has been tapped. And I think that further reflects, right, the incredibly sort of bad state of relations that we're looking at. Americans are not going to be looking at this the way that they probably looked at the catastrophe in Haiti a few months ago. They're not going to consider this, is my guess, the way that they looked at the tsunami in Asia several years ago. They've already spent billions of dollars in Pakistan to little end.
Susan Glasser, executive editor of Foreign Policy, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And, you know, you mentioned Haiti and the photographs, the films we are seeing of Haiti would indicate that much of that money, I'm wondering where it's gone when I see these constructs in the middle of the road, these shanties. I mean, how much have we helped? Why is it still such a disaster?
There was a fascinating article in Vanity Fair two issues ago about Sean Penn, who's sort of by default become, as it turns out, the head of the biggest relief organization currently operating in Haiti. It talks about his relationship with the U.S. military and how close they work. But I was struck by part of it that was sort of a throwaway detail of that piece, which was throughout the article, Sean Penn talks about how when he first got there, he said to his military counterpart, "You guys are just kind of sitting here. There's all this rubble. Why don't you have your people out clearing rubble?" And the response back was, "Those are not our orders." And those are still not our, those weren't the orders when we had 22,000 troops in Haiti. Those aren't the orders now that we have about 500 troops in Haiti. So part of it is the money issue. Where does the money come from? How could a corrupt, inept government spend it when its people have been killed and its buildings have been destroyed? Part of it is that the physical reality of Haiti is misery. There's rubble throughout the street. There's rubble in the earthquake zone. Very little of it's been cleared. And it raises a question, I think, for an American audience. America sent tremendous amounts of money, tremendous numbers of troops, but to what end? If we had troops sitting on the ground or off the shore of Haiti, why weren't they clearing rubble? Why weren't they taking rubble that was near the airport, the roads from the airport, and clearing it? Why weren't they in the middle of Port-au-Prince?
So it would also bring back the question of, even if the UN raised all the money it wants for Pakistan, how is it going to be used?
Diane, I think this is a really important question. And unfortunately, it does come back to governance. And Pakistan, you know, has a weak, incapable government fueled by corruption. Arguably, the more money we put into it, not only the less effective the money, but the more that it fuels the instability of the country itself. Haiti is another good example. It didn't have a functioning government and therefore society before the earthquake, so it's very hard to pour money into a system that doesn't exist. And I think that's what you're seeing.
And now we have Iraq's most senior soldier saying the Iraqi army will not be ready until 2020. What does that mean, Dan?
Well, I think one of the things it really means is that if you were a betting person, I think you would be very advised to bet that there will be still U.S. soldiers in Iraq after the 31st of December 2011.
The question is, how many?
Well, at the moment, they're supposed to come down to about 50,000 by the end of this month. That is from a peak of over 140,000 when President Obama took office. But I have to say, they talk an awful lot about the combat mission ending. Mm-hmm. And I would say a large part of that is just semantics. They're still going to be involved in counterterrorism. They're still going to be an essential support in terms of communications and logistics and transport. All the really difficult actions against al-Qaeda or against insurgents are going to be likely to rely on U.S. forces for some time to come, I would say.
Two quick points. One, on this issue of semantics, it's important to also look at what General Zabari, Babacar Zabari, was actually saying. He was asked about Iraq's ability to defend its borders externally, which is a very different issue when it has Iran on one side, Turkey on the other side. I mean, it has militarily powerful countries on all but solve its borders. That's a very different question from its ability to patrol within its borders. And frankly, the U.S. focus, rightly, has been, can you get Iraqi security forces capable of fighting insurgents, controlling areas, operating on their own? And there's been really remarkable progress. I mean, amidst all the bad news from Afghanistan, I've spent a lot of time with the Iraqi forces over the years. They've gotten markedly, markedly better. So the question of what their main mission is in the near future, they're already doing it. I would also add, though, that I totally agree with Dan's point. I think that there's no question in the mind of anyone I talk to in Iraq or at the Pentagon, that there will be an amendment to the deals to allow for some number, usually in the low thousands, is the figure I hear, to stay after 2011 when they're supposed to all leave.
Yeah. I think those are all really important points. A couple things I would add. One, which is that Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, had a large standing army whose job it was to, maintain internal as well as external order. This was, Saddam Hussein's police state, which functioned in a very militarized way. So they had something that they were reconstructing there, which is very different than Afghanistan, mm-hmm. which hasn't had a meaningful national army in a long time.
Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy. We'll be back after a very short break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
35 years ago, Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert began reviewing films together on TV. Now, after multiple incarnations, the show known as At the Movies will have its final broadcast this weekend. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview from our archive with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert. Join us.
And welcome back. During the break, we were talking about the training of Afghan units for military action. Last night on ABC, Martha Raddatz reported on the progress made in the training of a target of something like 170,000 Afghan soldiers, 95% of them. Do not know how to read, they didn't know how to drive, they didn't know how to shoot. Yoki Driessen, how can the U.S. be claiming that it's got all these trained Afghan troops?
I mean, to my mind, if they were illiterate and unable to drive, but willing and able to fight, maybe it'd be okay. I mean, this is a fierce culture. It's a culture that has a warrior ethos, and yet the insurgents are willing to fight. They're willing to go on what are clearly suicidal missions against heavily armored American vehicles. A lot, to my mind, the bigger problem with the Afghan troops isn't the literacy. It isn't the fact that a lot of them get stoned before they go out on patrol. It's that they're not willing to fight. When there are battles, they often flee. The battles are, the attacks are very poorly planned. The defection rate is astounding. The desertion rate is astounding. I mean, a lot of these guys, they'll come to be trained and then just disappear. Maybe they'll come back, maybe they won't. I mean, that to me is the bigger issue. But you hit on something really important, which is the sort of level of primitiveness of this society. I spent some time on a trip there once at the Kabul Military Training Center, which is the big, it's an enormous multi-square mile training facility outside of Kabul. The U.S. had spent, I think, about $12 million building a new dormitory for Afghan cadets. This was an officer training. So these were the creme de la creme of the Afghan army. And it lasted about 2 weeks because a lot of these young officers-to-be had never seen bathrooms in their lives. And they thought that you would clean up after yourself the way you did where they were from, using rocks, using bushes, using leaves, using tree branches. Trying to flush those things down a Western bathroom was obviously not going to work. So this beautiful building that was christened with lots of cameras and generals and, you know, a literal ribbon cutting was trashed in about a week.
Here's an email from James, who says, all the discussion fails to address whether the Karzai government or the Taliban want a stable country. This leads to suggest a monetary solution as opposed to a military one. Susan.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, what we've been discussing today is the fact that money can only go so far in buying you peace and stability. And unfortunately, if it were a question of writing a bigger check, I think there are a lot of people in the United States today who'd be willing to make that trade-off in order not to sacrifice any more young American men. I don't think that's the answer. Arguably, the incredible influx of American money to both Pakistan and Afghanistan has contributed to the protracted nature of this conflict.
And here's an email from John in Ontario, Canada, who says, if the U.S. and international forces are planning to leave Afghanistan, we need to ask, what was the point of the last 9 years of fighting? Osama bin Laden is still at large. The Taliban is becoming increasingly stronger. Now, in addition to what we already know about Taliban's treatment of women, there are stories in the news about the Taliban executing a pregnant woman, as well as a Time magazine cover with a beautiful young Afghan woman whose nose was cut off. How can those who strongly believe in women's rights argue that the international community should sit down with the Taliban? Daniel.
This is one of the great dilemmas that the international community has faced. You have had a series of movements which we in the West would find absolutely disgusting take hold in Afghanistan over 30 years or so. In fact, one of the first things that set off the Soviet invasion in 1979 was a revolt in Herat province against sending girls to school. People like Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright in the 90s felt very strongly that one of the reasons that Afghanistan had to be taken seriously was because of the appalling subjection of women. You can't see in parts of that country. You can't, and no one with an easy heart can sign off on a government that oppresses women in that way. And yet, how long can you enforce rights at the barrel of a gun? Can you argue that Afghanistan is a better place than it was 10 years ago? There are some figures that are good. There are some figures that are good. There are more children going to school. There are more girls going to school. But overall, in terms of the quality of life, in terms of security, it's not necessarily better.
I mean, the Time magazine cover, this one of the mutilated woman, which was horrifying, obviously, to anyone who heard about it, saw it. The headline for it is, what will happen if we leave Afghanistan? Which I thought was a bit of a bait and switch, because this was a woman mutilated while we're in Afghanistan.
Right.
This is a woman mutilated not pre-invasion, not post-departure, but while we're there. So to the question of, was it worth it? to my mind, the fact that you're having these kind of mutilations, this pregnant woman who was not only a pregnant woman, she was a pregnant widow, a widow accused of adultery, which seems logically kind of hard to square, who was flogged first and then killed. These are happening while we're still there, while we're sacrificing hundreds and thousands of people and hundreds of billions of dollars. The other point that I would just raise very quickly is you'd asked before about do people want a stable Afghanistan? I think another way of asking it is, what kind of stable Afghanistan? If a stable Afghanistan, security-wise, can be found by sitting down with the Taliban, accepting their treatment of women, is that a fair trade?
Is that what we want? Let's go to Cliff in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I'm listening. There were some questions asked before about whether we thought the war was worth it. You know, and it always is to the military-industrial complex. We were warned by Dwight Eisenhower and by many people beforehand that it's a self-perpetuating interest. Nobody in the military-industrial complex is going to say, hey, we thought about it, and hey, don't cut us any more checks. We're out of here. But we're basically, my point is, we're fighting a ghost. We don't know where Osama bin Laden is anymore. What we have in these areas of Afghanistan is over $1 trillion, by last estimate, I think, in The Economist, of natural resources that are available. We have all kinds of beautiful marble that rivals what Italy had during the Renaissance, and not really effective ways of extricating it. And we have implacable and intractable warlord leaders that we're dealing with, and we have not figured out reasonable psychologies for dealing with them. They are violent. They're vicious and in many ways barbarous, and we have not been able to affect them.
Susan.
Well, look, there's no question that the tragedy of Afghanistan, it didn't start on September 9th, 2001, which was when the Al-Qaeda operation began, really, with the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance. It didn't start then. It's been going on for several decades, and I think that's what makes this conversation particularly tragic, is that there is a consensus inside Afghanistan, perhaps that didn't exist in Iraq, to end war, to not have a conflict, even to welcome in NATO and the American forces in a way that certainly was not the case in Iraq. And yet, right, and yet, 9 years later, here we are having this conversation. For example, we talk about women, and I wanted to revisit that discussion we were just having. The tragedy of Afghanistan is not that it's a zero-sum game. Either we're going to be better for women under the Karzai government, or the Taliban is going to return and we have to see if we can make peace with the idea that they're going to resume their persecution of women. The Taliban come out of an aspect of Afghan society. These things are already occurring. They're still occurring in Afghanistan today. But one of the great tragedies is that this was not historically inevitable. Afghanistan in the 1960s and the 1970s before the Soviet invasion was arguably had progressive pockets. It had women being educated at Kabul University. Although it had reaction perhaps in Herat, it also was building a secular tradition of a different way forward for the country. I wanted to also mention the resource curse in Afghanistan. It is true that there appear to be extraordinary natural riches in Afghanistan. Although it is a landlocked country, it has many extraordinary and so far unexploited resources. But that's not necessarily a blessing either. I think anybody who thinks that we're going to just take billions of dollars out of the ground in Afghanistan and we're going to solve the country's problems and hand them a check and walk away, look at the story of natural resource-rich countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, where war has been fueled. Just like we were talking about money earlier, those natural resources represent an enormous future challenge for Afghanistan.
And Susan, I think you raise such a good point as far as the women go. If you read the successor novel to The Kite Runner, Land of a Thousand Suns, is that the right title? You really do understand the ups and downs that women have gone through, both in marriage and as single women throughout the history of that country.
Well, you know, having spent some time way back after the invasion of September 11th in Afghanistan. I spent about 9 months there, and it really is the conversations with women that I had there that stick with me the most. I remember being in Kandahar, you know, the birthplace of the Taliban, right after the liberation, of Kandahar, and meeting with a young woman there who had returned already to work as a teacher. She'd been secretly teaching children for the last several years. She had already begun receiving threatening night letters to her students and to herself, and yet she was absolutely determined to return to school and to create a different kind of a future. I often think about that woman and wonder what happened to her. I strongly suspect that she is not currently teaching in a public school in Kandahar somewhere.
All right, let's go now to Keith in Little Rock, Arkansas. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I believe that we are not culturally compatible from a standpoint of structural democracy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, meaning I don't believe that what we are trying to do there is necessarily compatible with our culture, which is not a good or bad thing. But my question to the panel is, why do we not pull out our troops from the region in their entirety, with the exception of special forces, and take the approach as follows? If our goal is to eliminate the counterterrorism insurgency, why would we not tell the Pakistani and Afghan government, we think there is a cell in this location, you have the opportunity to dismantle it within 24 to 48 hours, or our special forces will? And then we go in and strike from the air and remove our military ground forces and do what we pretend we're doing all along, which is to eliminate counterterrorism.
Daniel.
Well, I think you've brought a lot of points out there. I think, first of all, in terms of the cultural incompatibility, I think there are, one can't go too far here, but there are clear tensions here. People in the West sometimes see this as fighting for human rights, as we've discussed. People in Afghanistan increasingly see this as a war against the Pashtuns. And that is a problem. In Pakistan, for example, a large part of the US effort against Al-Qaeda, perhaps the single most important front of the war on terror, are CIA drone strikes that take off in Afghanistan and that bomb bases in Pakistan. And yet at the same time, those drone strikes incredibly increase US unpopularity.
Daniel Dombey of Financial Times, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Yogi.
You know, this idea, and it would be a wonderful one if it was plausible, unfortunately I don't think that it is, that you can stay out, rely solely on special forces and airstrikes. Remember, airstrikes and the civilian casualties they inevitably cause, no matter how careful you are in the targeting, this is a major problem. I mean, we were talking before that we went on about that Germany is going to be sending some more troops and also changing their mission slightly. But Germany had relied heavily on American air power, and it was not that long ago in Kunar province that there was a stolen fuel truck on a bridge. Germany, whose troops are not really allowed to engage in combat of any sort, called it an American airstrike. An American plane flew over the truck and bombed it, and the resulting fireball killed 140 people who were not insurgents but were instead villagers trying to siphon off fuel. Airstrikes are very difficult. They're very difficult when you've got 100,000 troops. They're very, very much more difficult if you have no troops and are relying just on spies and special forces.
I want to ask you all about Russia and its fires, the danger of a nuclear incident. Susan.
Well, it's hard to say exactly. Certainly, there's been a lot of warnings that there's leftover radioactivity from Chernobyl. There's several different nuclear facilities that have been threatened at various points by the encroachment of the fires. So that's a serious safety concern. As with the other natural disasters that we're discussing, of course, there's the government element. And I have been struck at the nature of the pushback to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin and President Dmitry Medvedev. Villagers are furious. Muscovites are furious. There's a sense that, as always in Russia, this is a natural disaster made worse by the incompetence or even worse by the active disdain of the Russian government for its citizens, which is why you have Prime Minister Putin in his famous series of ongoing photo ops. The other day, he was in a plane seen personally, supposedly knocking out forest fires by pressing water from a giant sort of water cannon from the air. And, you know, this video, I suggest you watch it. It's extraordinary. But it goes to sort of government by photo op, you know, and it's just been a catastrophe for Russia.
Yeah, this is actually one of the more striking things about it. Prime Minister Putin is not known to have a pilot's license, was flying in the co-pilot's seat and told that he'd scored a direct hit by the pilot. But just to go on this is a worrying phenomenon. There are 26,000 fires in Russia. Think about that number. And yet this again is being used not just as a government by photo op, but it's government by personality as well. And then one striking thing, someone in a blog said how disastrous the situation was and how much better it was in the days of the Soviet Union and how democracy hadn't brought anything better. And Prime Minister Putin commented on that blog and said, I agree with you entirely. It's not a very reassuring response, I have to say.
But it does seem to be, though, a perfect way to end a show that's on Friday the 13th. I mean, if you're talking about apocalyptic imagery, wildfires over 26, you know, tens of thousands of square miles of Russia, radiation in trees, radioactive smoke from burning trees go up into the air. It's sort of hard to imagine a more dispiriting and apocalyptic scenario, especially on an overcast Friday the 13th in Washington.
And what about simultaneously floods in Pakistan, which is why Barbara sends an email saying Yoki's numbers about corruption in Afghanistan are why I will not contribute to Pakistani relief efforts. And I fear a great many people are going to have that kind of reaction. Yoki Driessen of National Journal Magazine, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, Daniel Dumby of Financial Times, thank you all so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
And to all of you, thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.